Good afternoon. We want to welcome you to our third argument today. 2004 AP 1104 and 1105 CR State versus Angela Keys and State versus Matthew Keys. The oral argument, as I've got it, is Michael, is it Davini? For 10 minutes, representing Angela and Matthew. Mr. McCardo, 15 minutes, representing the amicus. And 30 minutes for Maura Whalen, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin. And then 5 minutes for you, Mr. Davini. You may proceed.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice and members of the court. May it please the court and counsel. This case asks the court to consider a situation concerning a fixed-price lump-sum construction contract for the building of a home and to interpret or reconsider the interpretation of the Court of Appeals of the phrase due or to become due. Our position in our brief is quite simply that the $36,068 that is at issue here was either due or to become due under any definition of that phrase, and that the Court of Appeals has reached an incorrect decision by attempting to reconstruct the phrase in certain ways. In the decision at page 12, they acknowledge the reasonableness of the Keys position, but they go on to talk about the fact that the statute would differentiate between claims due or to become due to subcontractors for labor and materials and monies used for any other purpose. And they indicate that the statute plainly prohibits a prime contractor for use of such monies for any other purpose until all claims have been done. They suggest that if a portion of the component of the cost of material supplied to a project includes profit, which we believe is always included, that profit must be sliced out of any payments to the builder. The one thing that is not at issue in this case is that the Wetsteins received all of the materials they bargained for at the price they bargained for. What the Keys would be penalized for is providing the materials and paying themselves the entire purchase price agreed upon in the contract, and the contract was well thought out. There were proposals submitted. Mr. Wetstein had to approve the proposals, and Mrs. Wetstein, and once they did, they had to sign a notice to proceed. The proposals included the prices for the rugs, the granite, the tiles, a variety of other things that are the matter in dispute here. Unfortunately, the Keys were fired in December before they could complete the contract. There is an implication within the case, although it's unproven, that someone remains unpaid for something. But I would submit to the court that is not part of the record in this case, and it has never been established.
Mr. Davini, if I can interrupt you for a minute, I know why you don't like the Court of Appeals decision. I think you've said that here and you've said it in your brief. But I'm somewhat concerned with the actual bindover by the circuit court. And let me just read to you my understanding of the bindover decision. This is coming from the Court of Appeals decision and paragraph 33. And the judge is saying, I'm going to find with respect to both of the defendants that there is probable cause to believe that a felony has been committed. That finding is significantly based on the fact that the accounting of the funds that were paid out by Mr. and Mrs. Keys, with there being a $47,000 amount due to the subcontractors and an unaccounted for amount of $36,000 from the accounting. There is an inference that the monies drawn from the account were not retained in trust and paid as they should. So the judge seems to be finding things contrary to what I just understood your argument to be. He seems to be finding that there's $47,000 that's due to the subcontractors, and that there's an unaccounted-for amount of $36,000, and that he can draw an inference from the testimony that he heard that money was not retained in trust and was not paid out as it should. Now, what's wrong with his determinations?
It's not supported by the record, Justice Crooks. It's there is no testimony that $47,000 is missing. I think there is a confused accounting, and unfortunately this case is developed only at the preliminary hearing stage. But what's most important, I believe, and I don't mean to divert your attention, but is the fact that the judge said that there is no doubt but that the Keys are owed the money. And from our position, once that determination is made that the Keys are owed the money, if there are certain people who have not been paid, for instance, if part of the $47,000 was not paid on the Wetsteins' watch, so to speak, after they fired the Keys, the Keys have no control of it. But if the Keys provided what they were supposed to, they are entitled to be paid for it, whether it was due at the time they delivered it or at the end of the contract. And even if they paid themselves too soon, under the statute, I would submit, it is not a crime. So that the court's finding, the court's placing importance on the $47,000, I believe, would be misplaced.
Well, isn't there testimony at the preliminary hearing from this CPA, Linda Jones, that would support the determinations that the court was making?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Justice, I'm sorry. And I think the most direct way to demonstrate that would be referring you to Exhibits 7 and 10, which are the last three pages of the appendix in my brief, my initial brief. These are the accountings that Linda Jones performed, accounting summaries, so to speak. The first, in which the state produced an evidence in the preliminary hearing, was dated May 13th. And it shows, at the bottom, $36,000 unaccounted for, almost the precise amount. Actually, it is the precise amount, $36,036.28, that is at issue in the case. We were able to establish, though, that she had prepared an earlier accounting on 12-24-02, which incorporated the materials that Angela Keys had supplied to the job, and that one showed only $3,701 missing. And that is in Exhibit 10, Justice. The second page of Exhibit 10, is an addendum which includes and documents all of the money paid to Angela Keys, and it totals $75,241.12. There is a notation next to it that says there's $3,454 unaccounted for, which is the price of installing the rugs, frankly, which virtually nullifies any loss or suggestion of loss as a result of monies paid to Keys. I mean, they're only being paid for what was provided. I know I'm not directly answering your question on the $47,000 because I don't understand the accounting that led the judge to make that comment. I don't believe it's supported in the record.
I'm looking at page 62 of redirect examination, and it looks as if Ms. Jones testified that there are outstanding bills or invoices from the subcontractors. She answers, I think it totaled about $47,000 in that neighborhood. I couldn't quote an exact amount.
And my answer, I guess, would be, Justice Ziegler, is I don't know what she meant by that. She wasn't being exact. And more importantly, it's not dated when in time. She is making these conclusions at this point. But as I have pointed out in my briefs, the Keys were fired in December. They were denied in its full draw in November, so that November and December and into January, work is still being performed. The house wasn't done. If there's people that aren't paid, again, our position is that this remains the fault of the Wetsteins. And I also pointed out in the brief, I think traditionally these cases are proven by calling in unpaid subcontractors, putting them on the stand and saying, I haven't been paid and I've submitted my bill and the money's been dispersed. That is not the type of case that's before the court today. That didn't happen here.
Can't hearsay be used at a preliminary examination?
I believe it can from certain things, but I guess I would characterize what she's saying more as speculation than even hearsay, Justice.
Thank you.
The trial court stated there's no doubt the money was due the Keys, And the Court of Appeals agreed in its decision at page 11. This reverts back to our main theory, which is if the money goes to the job, we believe the statute is intended to prevent people from taking money from one job and paying another job, robbing Peter to pay Paul. If the statute goes to the job, it is our position that there should not or cannot be a theft.
Is it expected that, let's say, I know there's a dispute whether there's a contractor, subcontractor prime, but let's say Keys is a subcontractor here, and under the statute, is it okay for a single subcontractor to be paid in full when there's a deficiency before others are paid in full or proportionately?
I believe it is, Justice.
What wording of the, I mean, I'm reading right from the statute. When I asked that question, 77902 sub 5 says the use of any money, this is the money in trust, by any prime contractor or subcontractor for any other purpose until all claims .. have been paid in full or proportionally in case of a deficiency. So it's okay to pay a single contractor in full before paying others proportionally.
At times it would be, Justice, and if thinking as to how construction projects work and the way the work trickles in depending on weather and stalls and delays in certain performance, if someone who has fully performed, I would argue, should be entitled to full payment. And again, if there is a deficiency in this case, there's no evidence to suggest it happened on the Keys watch. So I guess what I would suggest for the court is I don't see that as creating an unfair outcome potentially for other home builders as long as they're assured the money flows into their project. And I would point out the Wisconsin Dairies case cited by the state in its brief notes that the main purpose of the statute is to protect the owners from paying twice. And that is being done here and was done here. There's no suggestion the Wetsteins have paid twice for any materials to this house. I think it's important and would direct the court's attention to the fact that Mr. Wetstein himself in his testimony described a fairly protracted decision-making process in picking the materials that he bought from Angela Keys, and where he didn't want them from her, he went elsewhere.
Okay, counsel, your red light is on. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice.
You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. McArdle.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chief Justice Abramson and members of the court. I'm attorney William McArdle of DeWitt Ross and Stevens, and we represent the Wisconsin chapter of the Associated General Contractors, the Associated General Contractors of Greater Milwaukee, and the Associated Builders and Contractors of Wisconsin, collectively known as the Association Contractors in our brief. The Association Contractors respectfully argue that the June 14, 2007 decision of the Court of Appeals before this court today should be reversed. In the estimation of the association contractors, the decision prohibits contractors, including self-performing prime contractors, but also third-party subcontractors, from taking any proceeds other than the apparent cost of the labor and materials on the project until all other subcontractors are paid in full for their labor and materials. The decision is exceptionally unfair, then, as it places contractors in the position of foregoing not only profits, but other proceeds it may be entitled to for months or years. The decision ignores the realities of the construction industry, especially regarding projects having a long duration, and places subjects those contractors to possible criminal sanctions for activities that otherwise would be acceptable and considered under
practices. Do you read the Court of Appeals decision saying that the prime can only pay the subs for labor and material and can't pay the subs for profit?
The decision is essentially unclear. It says that it can pay all the claims due a subcontractor. Okay. But so, the statute itself, excuse me, Justice, the statute itself says that the obligations here, the criminal sanction, will attach not only to a contractor, and this, of course, is under the statute at the time of that this case arose. It has been subsequently amended, of course. But it attaches not only to the contractor, but also to the subcontractor. So the obligations, the trust fund obligations, apply not only to a contractor who receives money from an owner, but also a subcontractor who receives money from a prime contractor.
What do you propose? I read your brief. I understood what your problem was. As I understood it, you don't think that a sub should have to divide out between labor and supplies and profit and give a bill for the entire thing. You think it should be totally paid. I understood that. And I understand that you don't think a contractor who also self-performs, that is also a sub in part, that contractor cannot take any profits. I understood that. What I didn't get from your brief is, what rule do you expect this court to set forth?
I would expect that the court would interpret the statute in such a reasonable way that a draw system or some of the accepted practices in the construction industry relative to the amount of work that is performed, that is applied for by a contractor and provided to an owner, which also includes the costs of the work to the date performed by subcontractors and suppliers, that on that certification or an application for payment, that in fact that would be, those monies would be used to pay those contractors and subs and suppliers based upon their request for their application for payment. So if in fact that occurs, the money is being used for the project.
Well, that puts in all the subs put in their claims up to March 1. And you want the contractor to be able to put in its claims through March 1, too, which might include its profit as well as any of its costs, right?
I think that would be a fair assessment, and would also, in fact, be reflective of the realities of the construction industry.
Well, it's reflective of the realities of the construction industry if that's the agreement on the payouts, namely, as of March 1, 15% of the work is theoretically to be accomplished. We're going to give you 15% of the total, or maybe a little less so that there's a holdout at the other end. So you're going to get 12% or 10% of the total, and then those payments are made. And at least when I did it, we got lien waivers from everybody that appeared at the project as of that time. But that's not the only way payouts are made, as I understand it.
Well,
I mean,
no, I
the
understand.
Brief says there's great variety.
There are, in fact, a great variety, and it depends on the payment, perhaps the contractual arrangement that the parties have, the owner has with the contractor. There are lump sum contracts which state that for a stated sum of money we will perform a project according to the plans and specifications provided to us. There is cost plus, which means we will perform the work. We don't know what the overall cost will be, but it will be a cost plus a fee on top of it.
When does he get the fee?
Well, the fee is typically provided as the project goes along as a percentage of the cost. Under this decision, that is disallowed, and it criminalizes the conduct of the contractor by accepting that money and perhaps taking some of that cost or the fee itself, applying it to administrative expenses, such as a bond for payment and performance bonds on public projects. Under this decision, contractors cannot do that because the Court of Appeals has said that anything other than labor and materials paid to a sub is profit.
Mr. McArdle, is it correct that the contractors are taking the position that they're not getting into whether there should or should not have been a bindover on the criminal charges here?
Yes, Justice Crooks. So we take no position as to the aspect of this particular criminal case other than to say that the decision of the Court of Appeals criminalizes conduct which, in the association contractor's viewpoint, is otherwise an acceptable industry practice, which is to take monies that have been agreed to be paid for materials, what have you here, agreed to be paid, take them, use them for those purposes, take the payment. And under that circumstance, we think that this decision puts all contractors at terrible risk for criminal sanction.
Now, you seem to be taking the position, and I'm trying to follow up a little bit with the questions of the Chief Justice, but you seem to be taking the position that as long as the money that comes into trust to the contractor is used to pay either the contractor or subcontractors in regard to this project, that there's no criminal violations. Is that a fair summary of what you're saying?
I think that would be a fair summary under these circumstances, Justice Crooks. I would point out that the state itself, in its bidding contract, the contract for construction at the Division of State Facilities, Department of Administration, General Conditions of the Contract, which is a developed contract submitted to bidders to bid on particular projects for state construction, that particular document states that it states that overhead and profit margin is available for a change or a change order on the project. So if the scope changes in some respect, the contractors are allowed by the state to not only be paid for the cost of the change of the work, let's say we're going to paint the walls, whatever here, the cost of the change, but also a markup for overhead and profit. This decision says they cannot use that markup for overhead and profit until all subcontractors are paid. All right? Now, let's take the state capitol. How many years would it take to build the state capitol now? Easily 3 years. A prime contractor performing work, or even a subcontractor under this analysis, performing work is not allowed to use any proceeds other than what it paid for labor and materials, apparently the bare cost, any proceeds until the last subcontractor on the project is paid. And as Judge Dykeman points out, if the excavator comes in and does his or her work up front, why wouldn't there be an expectation that they be paid in full at that point, assuming the work is accepted? Why would they not be paid? And the claim is for all of their work, which perhaps includes a profit. So we get into the situation of timing. It would be terribly unfair to all contractors, not simply general contractors or the large general contractors, but all contractors. And frankly, this decision hurts more so the smaller contractors, the subs, and the suppliers.
Counselor, in this contract, wasn't there a provision for a holdback so that the full
Yes, there is. There is, in fact, a retainage. But Justice Robinsack, the retainage is typically a percentage of the cost.
I understand that. My question wasn't going to what a retainage is. What I was going to ask you about was, does the Court of Appeals opinion have any effect on the retainage in regard to the subcontractors, not the prime contractors?
I think that if the retainage, which is typically a percentage of all of the
right.
work,
right.
it would have an impact, because if you can only pay for the labor and materials of the subs, the retainage is, of course, an amount over the whole of the contract, including the subs' work. So the subs, who are bound by the same decision because they are a subcontractor under 779.02 sub 5, would also only be able to take that aspect, that portion of the money that they have.
What was bothering me was something a little bit different. I was thinking, if the general contractor, say, has a 10% retainage on the contract, and he's according to the Court of Appeals opinion, has to pay all the subcontractors before he can pay himself any profit, correct? Well, not only is he out the profit, but he's out the 10% on everybody else's work that's getting held up too, so it ends up being quite a significant amount. I don't really see how the general contractor, unless he did most of the work, could ever even come close to the profit with the retainage being on there of 10% for all the subs.
I would suggest in terms of the viewpoint of the association contractors that in fact, the and I agree, Justice Rogensack, the retainage is withheld typically by an owner. And it may be 5, it may be 10%, whatever it is, okay? That money is also, the contractors also withhold for subcontractors and suppliers for retainage.
Okay, so they don't pay that out then? They don't
it's not
pay
all
the
paid
whole
out.
Bill?
Okay. In fact, there is, under the state contemplates that some of it, in fact, because there is a prompt payment act for state work, that if, in fact, the state pays a prime contractor, it shall pay a sub within 10 days after being paid. But for the retainage.
Okay, so you pay him, but you don't pay the whole thing. So though the prime contractor has a retainage for the whole project, he is also retaining on each sub.
Contractors may be subject to retainage, okay. But it's a question of bargaining power. Some subcontractors would say, I'm the only game in town. I will not accept retainage being withheld. It happens all the time. So in fact, then a contractor who's having the dollars held from the owner is in fact taking on the additional risk there.
So it depends on the arrangement.
It depends on the arrangement. Okay. But at the end of the day, you can see that we would never, a sub or a prime self-performing would not be able under this decision to pay out anything other than labor and material to another contractor or supplier down the chain, so to speak.
What about this case, the Court of Appeals relies on Subkowiak a bit in its discussion. And Subkowiak, in interpreting the statute, indicates that they, and I'm reading from page 334 of Subkowiak, that what they can take are labor and materials due or to become due, and they're also free to use the balance for personal and other corporate purposes. That's what Subkowiak says. So it seems to me that they're just not limited to labor and materials, but also can use the money for the balance for personal and other corporate purposes. Does it ring a bell to you, or am I?
Yes, yes, Justice.
About
Bradley.
Something that's not registering.
I would suggest that. The decision of the Court of Appeals, though, states that rather than making a payment on draws that are otherwise accepted as being part of the costs of the work, that it is only the profit. So it makes a further differentiation here.
One further and last question. Is Angela a subcontractor here?
Frankly, Your Honor, the association contractor's view is no. Unless there is a separate entity, A self-performing contractor can't act as its own subcontractor.
So you agree with the state with regard to that?
I agree with the state to the extent that a contractor is a self-performing contractor. It puts further restrictions, of course, on a contractor. And under the analysis of the Court of Appeals, that analysis of that particular decision, I think it's a self-performing contractor. Right? And I think there's a distinction without a difference when you talk about acting as a subcontractor. Subcontractors perform specialized work or work that contractors can otherwise not perform. The contractors, if they can perform that work, will perform it as a self-performing contractor. I think there are some distinctions without differences in this particular case. But the overall issue is that not only for prime contractors, but also for the subs under 779 of 2 sub 5, they have the obligation to only pay out labor and materials. Otherwise, they may subject themselves to criminal sanction for which they do not know or are not aware of. Going back to a 3-year project, if you pay the excavator up front, one of the questions certified to the court, can you pay part of that to the court, or pay that to a subcontractor without paying the profits of the sub, without paying to the others. The issue, though, is how would a contractor know over 2 or 3 year time period? What does profit mean? A job can be profitable up front. It can go to become a terribly unprofitable job at the end. How are we, there's this definition of profit, which I would suggest the courts do not want to get into in terms of these commercial transactions.
I don't want to get into it, and I don't want to upset the entire industry. I don't think that the legislature intended that. I mean, that's clear. On the other hand, I still, suppose I write this decision. What is the standard I'm supposed to use? You said that, as I understood it, that as long as the money is paid to the contractor or the subcontractor for this project, there's no criminal activity.
As long as the money's paid to a contractor are used for purposes of constructing the project, be that the administrative expenses, the cost of a bond, the cost of insurance, the cost of safety programs, what have you, if that can all be allocated back to a project, then I think that's an appropriate determination.
Okay, but look, the way I've set this up, this project's going to cost $1 million out of pocket, everybody's, administrative, everything. But what's my rate of return? I mean, what kind of profit margin? I gather in this case 75% was too much as a profit margin. What's a margin? 5%? 10%? I mean, just give me a number. 20%?
Well,
just pick a number. It doesn't matter.
There is an anticipated margin.
Okay, what's the anticipated margin?
Oh, I think the anticipated margin, frankly, differs throughout the industry. Now, let's say there's gross profit of 20%.
I don't know what gross profit is. Profit on this project, say it's 20%. So when can I take that 20%? So the costs are going to be $1 million. I'm going to bid it $1 million plus 20% of that. Now, when do I, and I take that profit out. Maybe this project's going to last 2 years. I take the profit out at the end of the first year. And you say that's okay as long as I don't spend it on anything else. Well, I got to spend it on something else. That's my cash flow.
I agree. It should be the cash flow. And I would also suggest that under that $1 million scenario, you will also have some subcontractors that can perform work other than what the prime contractor is doing. So part of that $1 million will also have a component of the subcontractor's cost. Let's say that's $800,000 of the work. So really, there's $200,000 that the self-performing contractor does with a hoped-for 20% gross profit. The gross profit, though, includes all of the administrative expenses that a contractor must utilize or is mandated by the state under public construction.
But he has to take something home. He's got to live on this. He's got to pay
with
rent and food. And that's not going to be paid for the project,
and
right?
I say that
is he stealing
decision,
then?
I say this decision indicates that he or she is stealing.
I know, but I need to write a decision that says, okay, you can take out a reasonable amount, you can pay your rent, you can pay your food, you can send the kids to school, but there comes a time when you take money out of the project and then the project is left high and dry, right? That happens, right?
It can happen, that's right.
That's right. And that's the legislature's protecting that. So I need a standard.
At that particular point, that's where the retrospective view comes in as to whether or not this is criminal activity occurred at that point. There is also a self-regulating mechanism within the civil aspect of 779, which is that those who are not paid will file notices of intent, file claims for lien, or file claim under a bond if there is, in fact, a bond. And it actually puts the owner on notice before everything gets to be high and dry. So there are
usually
some
usually that's filed after these. Usually those liens are filed after everybody knows that he's high, that the contractor is high and dry.
In many instances, the notices of intent go out right away to inform the owner that, in fact, there may be an issue, which is, in fact, I think, good public policy.
Okay,
Mr. McArdle. The keys were very good to cede you some of their time.
Yes, thank you.
And I don't mean to pit you against each other, but you have asked that the decision of the Court of Appeals be reversed. Can you get what you want, with all due respect? Can you get what you want without reversing the decision of the Court of Appeals?
I think that the issue will then come down, Justice Prosser, to the overturning those aspects of the Court of Appeals decision that states that anything that is paid out other than the cost of labor and materials is not allowed, that is all that is accepted, and anything else a contractor may not take for itself until all subs on the project are paid. It creates a terrible conundrum for contractors and subcontractors because right down the line, they're also bound by this under 77902. There's no tiering of the subs here. It could be third tier, fourth tier, the supplier. Under that situation, everyone has to be wary of what they pay out or what they use, because retrospectively there may very well be criminal sanction applied. So do I think that under this particular case, could we get something? I know that I would suggest that the court is very adept, and I would certainly suggest that perhaps you may come up with a decision.
Counsel, this opinion has been out a year almost. It's now March. This is June 2007. What has the industry done to conform to this opinion?
I think the industry obviously here is submitted this amicus position. The industry believes that the court, this decision is in front of you. You need to make an interpretation, and I would imagine that the industry would look at perhaps further fine-tuning legislatively if that needed to be done. But this matter is before the court now, and we believe that that the decision, if left standing, will criminalize or subject so many contractors to potential criminal sanctions for activities that they may not be aware of were criminal at the time that the activity occurred.
Have they sought legislation yet?
Your Honor, I would say that on behalf of these three particular contractor associations right now, and by the way, the Allied Construction Employers Association also indicated they supported the position of the three that are named as the amicus here, that the legislation has not been proposed yet, because we think there is a rational interpretation to the statute that can be had without need to completely overhaul the lien laws. I would also suggest, and I'm sorry, that the laws changed in April of 2006. The lien law here changed from the law that we're looking at here. The Court of Appeals decision says you can't pay the labor and materials. The aspects that can be considered lienable and are therefore contractors would be entitled to now include services, plans, and specs. So we have a further conundrum now. What service are we talking about versus labor and materials? How do we know what to pay here? I lead you back, please, to the public contracting that is in place with the state of Wisconsin.
Counselor, why doesn't it just depend on what kind of contract the parties have? Here they had a right to draw based on the amount of work that was completed. Apparently there's a bit of a contest about whether that was complied with, but why doesn't it just depend on whatever the contract says?
Because the decision itself does not depend on what type of contract is out there.
Well, why shouldn't our decision say it depends on what kind of contract the parties have?
Well, we know that under the state, and there is a concomitant statutory reference 779.16, theft by contractor in the public matter under which the state construction would apply, we know that the state, in almost all instances, will ask for lump sum contracting, fixed price, based upon a set of plans and specifications that are developed prior to bidding. In almost all of that work, that's what happens. All right? So you're going to have a lump sum situation with the state, which is the largest, frankly, consumer of construction services in the state.
But usually in those contracts, I mean, I built my house for a lump sum, and with my general contractor, he could take a fourth, and a fourth, and we had the dates set for those fourths, the last fourth being after everything was completed, and we'd had a walkthrough, and I said, okay. But it was a lump sum contract. Doesn't the state have similar provisions that the contractor gets something as he goes along?
Yes, it's a lump sum, and the contractor gets, including the acknowledgement of overhead and profit as it goes along, reflected in the change order issue. If they decide to make a change to the scope of the project, the contractor is allowed overhead and profit.
So again, you're just looking at what kind of contract they have.
You get back to looking at what sort of contract it is, but you could get a cost. I mean, there are cost plus, there are all sorts of contracts out there.
Well, but I think the cost plus, doesn't that go to what the bottom line is? But if you just say you had a cost plus, that wouldn't prevent the contract from saying you can take draws at particular benchmarks.
No, not at all.
Mine was when the roof was on. That was the first draw.
Typically, you would have that in a home construction situation.
Right. Okay.
But this particular statute applies not only to home construction, but also
to everything. I understand.
And the contract can't cut out the subs, and it can't cut out the homeowner. So you couldn't have a contract that, in effect, would allow violation of the statute.
No, I would suggest that you can't have a contract that would allow.
Pardon me?
I would suggest that you cannot have a contract that would allow a violation of
the
statute.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Whalen?
Good afternoon. May it please the court, I'm Maura Whalen, appearing on behalf of the state. I want to begin by saying that the fearsome scenario described by amicus are not justified by the majority opinion. And more importantly, they're not justified by any reasonable construction of the statute, which is narrow in scope and limited in purpose. First, the statute limits the prime contractor's payment obligations to all claims due or to become due or owing. In other words, billed claims for work that has been completed on the construction contract. Thus, the statute does not address the prime contractor's obligation to pay future claims by subcontractors who have not yet done any work. Second, the statutory trust fund comes into existence at the moment that the prime contractor receives mortgage proceeds or monies from the owner. The trust fund is extinguished when the prime contractor has paid all outstanding claims. Any balance or residuum from the mortgage proceeds left in the prime contractor's hands after the trust fund has been extinguished is beyond the scope and purview of the statute. In short, the statute simply doesn't care about the residuum. In a case like the present one, where the payments are made in a series of periodic draws, a trust fund comes into existence when the prime contractor receives the draw. What he must do with his trust fund obligation is pay the claims that are due or become due or owing from all the subcontractors. Once that obligation has been fulfilled during that draw period, any balance or residuum from the draw is the prime contractor's to do with what he will. Now, there is the danger, I point specifically to amicus page 5, where a scenario is presented of a particular kind of contract where, well, the prime contractor doesn't really know what profit he's due in the long term, and so maybe if he takes too much money out of the periodic draws, maybe in the long term in the contract, he'll have taken too much profit. Now, that may be. And if a prime contractor takes too much profit as understood under the particular contract, there may be contract liability or tort liability, but there is no criminal liability under this statute because the statute doesn't care about profit and whether he's taken too much profit. The statute only cares about making sure on a payment-by-payment basis that the prime contractor has paid the subcontractors who have billed him for work.
Ms. Whalen, let me interrupt you then.
Mm-hmm.
What does the state claim that the defendants did inappropriately here that justifies the bind-over?
Well, the state claims that $47,000 worth of subcontractor claims were unpaid. And that number and statement is made, as Justice Ziegler pointed out, on page 62 of the transcript, and I think it's reiterated on pages 63 and 64. The terms Ms. Jones uses, unsatisfied claims. That is unrebutted testimony. Granted, it's not very specific, it's general, but it's an unrebutted testimony that there are $47,000 worth of unpaid claims, and that is sufficient for bindover to show that there are unpaid claims of something more than $2,500.
Do you agree that there was no tag to time with those $47,000 worth of unpaid claims, or is there something you could point to the record that would at least infer that Keyes should have paid those?
Yes. Well, first, I just want to point out that this only came up in the reply brief, so I really think it's beyond waived. However, I do think that there is some specific evidence that we can look at. And so now I'm going to sort of shift the conversation away from the $47,000 to some other money.
Well, Ms. Whalen, if I could, I was trying to follow your answer to Justice Crooks and what would justify the bind over here. And mm-hmm. your response, as I heard it, was $47,000 in unpaid claims.
Mm-hmm.
But as I understood Justice Crooks' question, it was what conduct did the Keyes do that would justify the bind out over? And it seemed to me that under the statute, you have to have something more than just not paying the $47,000.
Well, so there are the $47,000 in unpaid claims and $36,000 that Jones found to be unaccounted for in her very exhaustive analysis of all the records under the contract. $36,000 that wasn't accounted for by payments to subcontractors, payments to Matt Keyes for labor, and payments to the Keyes for materials and supplies that they purchased for the contract. So those are the two basic numbers looked at. Now, to be fair, it is not immediately clear from the record when this $47,000, $36,000 problem took place. But there is one thing we can look at in the last, the month of November. On November 8th, the Keys took two draws, and this information I'm about to say is you can find in the Linda Jones, what I call the May and December charts that are in the record. They took two draws that equaled nearly $31,000. During the month of November, according to Linda Jones' unrebutted testimony, or maybe not during the month of November, but after November 8th, Matt Keyes paid himself $14,000 in labor costs, which I would point out is nearly half of the total labor cost he collected for himself over the 7 months, so that does seem strange. Okay, but $14,000 in labor. Meanwhile, I forget which exhibit it is, I think Exhibit 11, where Angela sets out her costs and profits for supplying the materials to the subcontractor, to the Wettstein contract. She was paid $14,600 for those materials. So, in other words, the Keys paid themselves out of a $31,000 November 8th draw in the next few weeks, they paid themselves $28,600, nearly the entire draw. Now, since prior to November, this contract was in full swing, it seems highly improbable that there was only $1,500 worth of claims, which would, I get the $1,500 by subtracting what the Keys paid themselves from the November draw, due and owing from the subcontractors. It seems that there must have been some far more significant amount of money that they were supposed to be paying to the subcontractors in November. And therefore, I think it's a fair inference, a reasonable inference, that some, if not all, of that $47,000 was money due and owing in November. But certainly the only amount, even we're in preliminary hearing now, as we all know, but even at trial, of course, all the state has to prove for a felony is $2,500. So that's I would just point to that November analysis to support the bind over.
Counselor, is there anything in the record that would show that prior to November 8th there had been subcontractor bills submitted that should have fallen under the $31,000 that was taken?
No, it's just an inference from the evidence. There's no I have to admit that the bind over evidence is not as specific as it could be.
Is there anything in there to show the kind of work that was done on the house that would have been attributable, even without a bill, to the subcontractors during this period of time?
I think that you could infer what kind of work is being done from reading the chart called a recap, developed by Linda Jones in terms of the money that was paid out, and by looking at the names of the businesses that were paid out. I think that's the only that's the only kind of specificity you could get.
Then,
on that.
Getting back to Justice Butler's question, I'm having a little trouble with identifying the, quote, conduct that mm-hmm. violated the statute. I mean, at first I thought you said that there were $47,000 worth of subcontractor bills that should have been paid, mm-hmm. but there weren't. There weren't subcontractor bills that are in the record, you tell me.
Oh,
then
okay.
I thought, well, maybe it was $47,000 of apparent subcontractor work. And you tell me that's not there either. I'm having a little trouble.
Okay, I understand the question now.
Okay,
The unrebutted testimony from Linda Jones is that there were $47,000 in unpaid subcontractor claims. Claims are bills for work that has been done. That is in the record, and that is unrebutted. Is it specific? Is it broken down by subcontractor? No.
See, I first tried to put you back on a timeline,
mm-hmm.
which was the Keys attorney's argument that even if $4,700 was unpaid, well, you know, it wasn't on their watch, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Mm-hmm.
Then you began to answer Justice Butler's question about what kind of conduct, and you went to this November 8th draw, okay? And so I'm trying to hear how conduct that would be on the Keys watch fits in there. And I'm still not having any luck.
Well, the conduct would be that they paid themselves in November $28,600.
Maybe they did that amount of work or bought that amount of materials. That would be all right, wouldn't it?
Well, I'm even willing to concede for the sake of argument that they would be entitled to those payments under subcoeac. But
uh-huh.
even if even if they are entitled to those payments under Subcoeac, as came up in one of the previous arguments, they are not entitled to pay themselves in full if there are other outstanding subcontractor claims. They have to pay that proportionally.
And that goes back to my question. Are there other subcontractor claims that fit within, that would have come in by November 8th, because that's what you're pointing us to as they're taking that draw, and I haven't heard you identify any subcontractor claims.
And I'm admitting that I am inferring, it's an inference from the record, that though at least some of those claims, some portion of the $47,000 may have come in before, while it was, we were still on the Keys watch. For one thing, the Matt Keys, Linda Jones started investigating the case around December 10th. Matt Keys took his tools away on December 20th. The idea that there could have been this $47,000 worth of work occurring after the contract fell apart seems improbable, and the less reasonable inference than the inference that at least $2,500 was taken illegally. But I would like to just point out that this is a situation where the waiver argument, I think, is extremely significant. This issue was never raised before the appellant's reply brief. When, in arguing against Bindover, the argument was a legal one, which is this is the Keys' legitimate profit and we're entitled to take that profit. Moving to dismiss the Bindover, again, it was a legal argument, but a little different this time, which is Angela was entitled to take that $36,000 of profit because she's a subcontractor like any other subcontractor. And so, therefore, the use of the money was legitimate. On that basis, there was a petition for leave to appeal to the Court of Appeals on this specific legal question. Can you be a subcontractor and can you take profit? The case was then appealed, brought to this court on the basis of these legal arguments. It's an especially inappropriate situation to allow the appellant to raise a waived claim in a reply brief. And I can tell that haven't been very successful in convincing Justice Rogensack on what we could call my November theory. I would say that if I had been able to brief this in my brief, I would have been able to argue it perhaps more convincingly, or at least, you know, we all would have read it and thought about it, and this discussion would be perhaps more productive than it's been.
Ms. Whalen, let me interrupt you for a minute. And I'm thinking about the Court of Appeals decision, and I'm thinking about specifically the concurring opinion of Judge Dyckman. Judge Dyckman indicates that he disagrees with the reasoning and a lot of the discussion by the majority, but he goes along with the bottom line. And he goes along with the bottom line because he's convinced that the testimony shows that the profit taken by the defendants was 75%, and that that's an outlandish profit, and therefore that there's a violation of the statute. Do you agree with that reasoning?
Upon rereading my brief, I saw that I did agree with that, but I actually no longer agree with that particular point because, as I said at the opening of my argument, I think that the statute doesn't care about profit and that if the Wetsteins agreed to pay her a 75% markup, that's their business. I'm not certain that the record supports that they agreed to that, and so perhaps if she took 75% markup, and that's really not what they agreed to, again, we have a
perhaps some kind of breach of contract or related tort action. But I think, so I don't think, oh, you took 75% profit is a violation of the theft by contractor statute. I think it is significant, though, for two reasons to the overall resolution of the case. And the first is that it supports the inference of wrongful conduct because or intentional wrongful conduct because it is so exorbitant and it seems like something that the Weinsteins wouldn't have actually agreed to. But there's a more important conceptual reason that it's significant, and that is goes to the subcontractor argument, because it, which we haven't talked about, but if there were any argument, a convincing argument that a prime contractor could act as a subcontractor in some other sense, it would violate the purpose of the statute to let such a subcontractor who can inflate their claims be treated like any other third-party subcontractor.
So
it's significant for those two reasons. I'm sorry.
I just want to make sure I'm following the state's position clearly. For purposes of this question, you are the contractor. Mm-hmm. The three gentlemen at the table are subcontractors. You each submit a claim for $25,000. You each have outstanding claims for $25,000, but you have a draw of $50,000. Now, if you pay yourself and if you pay Mr. Devaney, is there a violation of this statute?
Yes. I would say that under that scenario, so the four of us basically have, under the contract, legitimate claims of $100,000, but I've only gotten $50,000 in the draw. Is that the, those are the facts? First of all, we have to, it depends on what my $25,000 is based on. To make it easy, let's say it's based on labor, because under Subcoiac, we know that I can pay me for labor. Okay, so we'll say that it's for labor.
I'll make it even easier for you, because as I see most subcontractors, when they submit a bill, they're not just going to submit it for labor. They're going to submit their bill for their labor. They're going to submit the bill for the materials, and they're going to have some profit built in. I don't think subcontractors do it differently, right?
Right, but I'm talking about the prime contractor.
I just want to just get my question. I want to make sure I understand your argument.
Right.
So you've got four individuals down there. You've all done, have a claim for $25,000, which includes your labor, it includes your materials, and you've got a little profit built in. But the draw is for $50,000. You don't pay two, you pay two, and you're one of the two that you pay. It seems to me that your argument, if I'm understanding you correctly, is that there's a prioritization that you see in the statute that you have to pay the subs before you pay yourself, even though you may have a legitimate claim. Is that correct?
That's correct. But in the particular scenario you raised, I would have to, if I paid, if I had $50,000 and I paid myself $25,000 and Mr. Devaney $25,000, I would be violating the statute. But also, if I didn't pay myself anything and I paid Mr. McArdle $25,000 and paid Mr. Devaney $25,000, I would also be violating the statute because I didn't pay the other subcontractor. I have to, in that case, if there were insufficient funds, I would have to pay proportionally to all of the subcontractors who had outstanding claims.
And to just finish my question, where in the statute does it call for proportional payment?
In I think it's around the last sentence.
That's what I was looking for.
Yeah.
It says, and in case of a deficiency, payment must be proportional.
What if then, go ahead, Justice Crosser.
Could I ask, if this case were assigned to me, could I just take the Court of Appeals opinion and follow it paragraph by paragraph and put out an opinion? Or would you be happy with that?
I wouldn't do that. And the reason I wouldn't do that is not because I see any flaw in the opinion, because as I said in my opening comments, where I think that the majority opinion does not give rise to the fears expressed by the amicus, clearly the amicus feels that it's written in a bad way. And perplexingly to me, so does Judge Dykeman, and he must have spoken to the majority. So there, even though I can't understand how the majority opinion has been interpreted in this no profit until the end way, clearly some people are interpreting that way. And so certainly what this court can do in an opinion affirming the Court of Appeals is clarify the issue and explain more clearly what the statutory obligations are, which is that with each draw, the prime contractor has to satisfy those outstanding subcontractor obligations, but he is not prevented from taking any profit before the end of the subcontract.
And but he's not prevented by giving the subcontractors profit either. You're not going to try and divide out the 25 grand for each of those.
Oh, yeah, products. Yeah. That's the issue of the subcontractor's profit, I think, is I think that the way I understand a claim is the bill that is sent. Okay, and the bill from a subcontractor is going to be including the negotiated profit that he's brought in. So I think that, therefore, understanding claim in that way, the subcontractor's profit is built in. But I would also point out that the statute does give the prime contractor some protection against perhaps a fraudulent or otherwise problematic bill from the subcontractor. Maybe the prime contractor thinks that, hey, this profit is exorbitant, or he didn't really work that many hours. The statute allows the prime contractor to withhold any payment for a bona fide dispute with the subcontractor.
Well, you say clarify the Court of Appeals, and my question was, Justice Prosser was going to say, how do you clarify it?
Well, I open my remarks saying that you clarify it, I guess, by just walking the reader through the statute very, very carefully.
Where in your brief do you do that, Ms. Whaler?
Well, I said it in my opening remarks. In my brief, I numerously point out, because remember, I wrote my brief before the amicus, so it was only after that I thought, well, gee, this does seem to be confusing people. But I say several times in my brief that after the prime contractor has satisfied the subcontractor's claims, he may use the balance of the money for any other purpose, including profit. In one of my references to subcoeac, I know, is one of the times that I point that out, and I believe I also point it out in the last section where I'm trying to respond to Judge Dykeman. I think that the language of the statute is clear that the obligations are only for claims that are due, and that the trust fund only lasts as long as those obligations are outstanding.
Suppose in our hypothetical, you not only have the three that have sent you bills, but you know there are four others that are just late in sending you bills. Now we're way over it. could be that you got 100,000, but you know very well that there's 50,000 out there more. What do you do then?
I believe that that actually is something that is ambiguous in the statute. I had originally understood the claims due or to become due or owing to refer to all work that has been completed. And I know that at least one of the cases that I cite in my brief just uses the sort of completed work language. But I'm not really sure. I think that, and it's not really before the court, but certainly it's, I think it could be an important question in this case or other cases. And I see policy reasons on both sides of the argument. On the one hand, this statute really tried to cover the waterfront and make sure the prime contractor is paying all the subcontractors that he knows he's going to owe money to. And so that, of course, would include people who've done the work but not paid the bills. On the other hand, it perhaps would put too much administrative burden on the prime contractor to have to not only calculate when he's applying for that draw what claims are due or to become due and owing, but to say, well, I think the bricklayer is going to be done. Well, wait a minute, or maybe he is done. I'm not really sure, but he's almost done, and I'm not really sure what the bill is, but I have to come up with that. So I think that the work done, not yet billed, is the one thing in the statute that I do think is ambiguous.
Ms. Whalen, if I could, Judge Dykeman, in paragraph 40 of the opinion, talks about the rule of lenity and says that we've got two interpretations here that may be reasonable. And he talks about the state's no profit until the end approach. He talks about trust funds must be used on the job approach, his suggestion. Given the conflicting interpretations, why is the rule of lenity not applicable here?
Okay, this is multi-part, so jump, you know, remind me if I've forgotten any of the parts. The first thing that I want to respond to is that the trust funds must be used on the job interpretation is not a reasonable interpretation of the statute. And there are three reasons. First of all, no one on this side of the issue has pointed to any statutory language that supports this position. There's just none. Second of all, it renders superfluous the very language we've been talking about for the last hour, which is the all claims due or to become due, et cetera. The statute is very specific that that's what it's about. It's not just using it on the job. The statute concerns itself with paying those subcontractors. Also, the interpretation defeats the purposes of the trust fund, which is to protect the third-party subcontractors and the owners. If you just say, well, as long as I'm paying, using the money on the job, I'm acting consistently with the statute, is simply untrue. If I were to choose to pay just Mr. Devaney for his work on the job and not to pay my other two subcontractors. Okay, first of all, they're not getting the protection they're supposed to get. And second of all, the owner is now in trouble because they can file liens against the owner for the unpaid money. So that's the first part of my answer, is that it's not a reasonable interpretation of the statute. And second of all, maybe that's satisfactory, but I would point out that sometimes the argument in this case seems to be premised on that we're dealing with something novel. In fact, some version of this statute has existed in the state of Wisconsin for 100 years. There have been, 20 cases, both criminal and civil, interpreting this statute and interpreting its intent of protecting subcontractors and owners. There's no surprise here. And the first case considering it from its criminal aspect was Pauley versus Keebler in 1921. I just don't think there's any room for applying a rule of lenity approach with that amount of history. Also, in terms of the rule of lenity approach, Judge Dykeman is proceeding from the premise that Angela can work as a subcontractor and is therefore entitled to be treated like any other subcontractor. If you're not even agreeing with his premise, and I obviously don't agree with that, but you have to accept that premise before you even think that the rule of lenity is at all appropriate here.
Could I ask, this might be a very faulty analogy, but for me, a prime contractor is sort of like a ringmaster.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are you saying that a ringmaster can never be a performer? I mean, once you're the ringmaster, you can never perform. You always have to wait for all the acts, and your act just doesn't get paid.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I think that in our analysis of the case and in the case law, specifically Subcoeax, and as the amicus also said, certainly a prime contractor can self-perform some of the contractual obligations. That's not what's really at issue here. What's at issue is, other than paying himself for labor and reimbursing, that's Subcoeax's word, reimbursing himself for expenses spent on purchases of material, he must pay all of the other subcontractors before he takes any more money. If he thinks, oh, well, I'm entitled to profit on those materials, fine. He can have that profit, but not until he's paid the other subcontractors for the money.
At least those that were billed.
Right.
Not everybody coming up forever.
Not in all those people in the future. The painters, for example. 3 months into the contract, you don't have to think, oh my goodness, what do I owe the painters? I also just think it's important to remember that it's the prime contractor who is going to the bank and saying, this is what the draw should be this month. It's the prime contractor based on the bills he's gotten from the subcontractor, the degree of profit that he and the owner have agreed to under the contract to be paid proportionally. And this also goes to any retainage payments, how they play in. I mean, the prime contractor can say, okay, I've got $30,000 in subcontractor claims this month. I've got $10,000 of my own, let's call them Subcoeax expenses, and I've performed 10% of the contract, so therefore I'm entitled to 10% of the profit we agreed to, and that's what I'm going to base my draw request on. So the prime contractor really has some control here about the rate at which his profit is dispersed and any other money that he needs. And I think the statute, again, and I know I'm way over time now, but it is very narrow and clear in its purpose to protect those subcontractors and to impose those obligations on a month-by-month or whatever, some kind of periodic basis.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Devaney?
Mr. Devaney, could I just ask you a question right off the top?
Justice, may I say one thing first? I've agreed to subcontract 1 minute of my time to Mr. McArdle. 1 minute.
Your job, it seems to me, is to get the decision of the Court of Appeals reversed. Okay. Why couldn't we walk through the statute step by step and clarify this and clarify that and still have a bind over? Tell me why we have to reverse the Court of Appeals.
I'll tell you, and I hope it doesn't offend you what I'll say right now, because it's not really a legal argument, but it's an image I've had in my head that's haunted me all this case. And it is that every morning this case has been going on for 4 or 5 years, the Wetsteins got up in the morning, they stood on carpets that they were put in by my clients, the Keys. They walked across tiles that were put in by my clients, the Keys. They used the fixtures in their bathrooms that they put in. They reached into cherry cabinets and took out their coffee cups and put it on granite countertops, all supplied by my clients. They got everything they paid for, and I can't believe that's a crime. So my response is not necessarily a legal one, with the exception that, under those circumstances, the record omits any evidence of an intent, a criminal intent, and also it establishes, by showing the proposals and the contract process, the consent of the Wetsteins to do exactly what was done, and that there is no crime.
You think the record for preliminary hearing purposes adequately reflects that there are subcontractors who are unpaid to the tune of around $47,000?
No, Justice Bradley, I don't. And I'm glad you raised that because
let,
I wanted to address
it. Let me read
it.
Some things from the record and tell me why this isn't adequate. Talking about the testimony of Ms. Jones, page, let me start, 62 of the transcript. Based on your review of the record, question, based on your review of the record, and this is appendix 62. It's in the trial transcript. I don't know what it is in the appendix. In the transcript it says, based on your review of the record, had all subcontractors who had provided labor or materials been paid as of the time of your review? No, they were not. And what were the outstanding bills or invoices from the subcontractors? I think it totaled about $47,000 in that neighborhood. I couldn't quote an exact amount. Page 63. And there were about $45,000 to $47,000 worth of labor and materials which subcontractors have provided that had not been paid for? Question. Answer. That's correct. Page 64. So after the last draw, which was on November 8th, there were unpaid invoices, but he continued to pay himself? Question. Answer. According to his accounting records, the document that he turned in. So why isn't that enough to have for preliminary hearing purposes? You've got testimony from someone that said there's 47,000 in that neighborhood of unpaid invoices as of the last draw on November 8th. Why isn't that enough for that issue? Do I need greater details?
Yes, Justice.
What greater detail do we need?
What was referred to are claims. Not bills that were submitted. And in the accounting, in Exhibit 7 and Exhibit 10, both versions of Linda Jones' accounting, there's no reference to unpaid bills. I understand that she says this, that there are $47,000 unaccounted for, but it's not tagged in time.
Okay. Page 64. So after the last draw, there were unpaid invoice questions. So after the last draw, there were unpaid invoices, but he continued to pay himself according to his accounting records. The documents that he turned in is the answer.
But that is inherently inconsistent itself, Justice. After the last draw, he couldn't have paid anybody.
Well, what about, does that go to plausibility, credibility? Is she not telling the truth? What's going on here?
I think, because I can't answer directly your question, that the answer comes back to the fact that the money went to the job, that nothing was taken that wasn't agreed to by contract. In some ways, I understand the state's argument to be the counter of the question posed by Chief Justice Abramson. We don't want to have contracts that interfere with or a statute that nullifies a contract, but that is what is being proposed here, that the people can't contract with each other for what they're going to buy and what they're going to pay for what they buy, because it'll be micromanaged by the courts to decide at some point later on that maybe one person's opinion that the profit was too high is a basis to challenge it, or there, in this case, or there's a breakdown between the parties and somebody's fired before they can finish the contract, which is an important ingredient in this mix, I think, the fact that the Keys were fired. If I...
Are you ready? ready to cede to the subcontractor?
I think I must, Chief Justice. Thank you.
Mr. McArdle, you've got 60 seconds.
Thank you, Justice, Chief Justice Abrahamson. I appreciate the court being able to allow the subcontractor to come up. Now I also hope to be a supplier of some additional information for you here. Please keep in mind that the statute applies not only to a prime contractor, as Ms. Whalen discussed today, but also to the subcontractor who receives money from the prime contractor. So the same conundrum continues under this particular decision. The subcontractor makes a claim, says, I am owed $25,000. May or may not include profit. We don't know. It's lump sum. However, the prime contractor must pay the subcontractor under the analysis and make sure that until everything's claimed, no profit's taken. Profit's not defined. Could be any other proceeds. That same subcontractor should not be able to take anything other than the labor and materials because it's bound as the prime is. I think that's important for you to remember that the decision as it stands right now affects not only the prime contractors but also subcontractors, anyone who receives money that is in trust.
How many of these cases against contractors come up in a year? Do you know?
I think there are a number of them. I think there are a number of cases that come up, and it comes up. I think with some regularity that the issues come up. There certainly are situations where there are egregious cases. We understand that. Where, in fact, perhaps some home builders take funds and never perform any services, have you. The association contractors here, though, ask the court simply to acknowledge that there are, in fact, this is, in fact, a highly regulated industry that has checks and balances in place. And to the extent that Ms. Whalen mentioned that the prime decides the payment scheme. That's not necessarily the case at all. As you all know, there is either a project representative, there certainly is for the state, there's an architect engineer. Everyone who vets these applications for payment that I discussed earlier. So it is not simply the prime contractor that determines what he or she is going to take. There are systems of checks and balances in place, and that's why I also believe that in terms of the civil aspect of 779 here, there are some self-regulating provisions relative to notice of intent to file a claim for lien, putting owners on notice, what have you. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank Mr. Devaney, Ms. Whalen, and Mr. McArdle for their arguments today on construction theft issue. It's been very interesting. And this, we will now close the arguments in 2004A, P1104 and 1105 CR, State versus Angela and Matthews Keys. The court will meet in the conference room at 3:30. We are in recess until our third day in oral argument later in the month.